time we have a quarrel, it almost breaks my heart. 'Cause I'm so afraid that we will have to part. Each night I ask the stars up above.
The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by the Maryland State Education Association. From school funding to Common Core, you can learn about the important issues affecting Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting the Maryland State Education Association's website at MarylandEducators.org. That's one word, MarylandEducators.org. Or you can go to SteinerShow.org and click on the Maryland State Education Association's banner. And welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, of course, and that was A Teenager in Love by Dion the Belmonts. And on this day in 1991, Doc Pomus, who wrote that song, passed away. We're about to have a conversation about Leo Breitholtz, who passed away this week. He was a Holocaust survivor, much more than that. Michael Lesker is with us, who is a dear friend of mine, but a dear friend of Leo Breitholtz. He wrote the book Leap Into Darkness with Leo, about Leo's life in the Holocaust and more. And of course, Michael Lesker is award-winning columnist for over 30 years and still writes and writes numerous books. Has a new book out that we'll be talking about very soon together on the air. But he's here with us today to talk about Leo Breitholtz. And Michael, welcome. Good to have you in the studio, man.
Thanks for having me. And I'm glad we have a chance to talk about Leo, who was, as you said, much more than just a survivor of the terrible thing that we've come to know as the Holocaust, but was a man who took what might have been bitterness and turned it into what became for thousands and thousands of people a learning experience to tell everyone that we must never divide ourselves by race, by religion, by ethnic background, by anything of that nature, that we're all just human beings and that we have to be kind to each other. And that was his message for his whole life. He took what could have been bitterness and anger, having seen his own family,
right,
as well as so many others killed, he turned that into a message of love.
You know, it's interesting. One of the notes I got back when I got back from the funeral, Leo's funeral, we sat together there, your wife and you and I. So I got a Facebook message from John Wesley. John Wesley is a local musician and activist, and he happened to be Fannie Lou Hamer's godson, and we're working on a project together. And he wrote this piece, and let me just read what he wrote about Leo. I mourn the loss of my friend, Leo Breitholtz, the Holocaust survivor. We met while working at Beyond Swastika and Jim Crow exhibit at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum. He was a remarkable man whose quest for survival and his determination that the history of his people never be forgotten was and is inspiring. Privately, he showed me the symbols, numbers, stars, and scars from his journey. He'll be missed. He's hoping his work will go on.
Lovely.
And that was Leo.
Yeah. You know, it took him a long time to talk about it. Like a lot of survivors, it took him years to get beyond the pain. It took him years to, like a lot of them, to find the grammar of their pain. It wasn't until the 60s that he started to talk about it, 15, 16 years after the war. And I met him in the 1970s. He ran a bookstore on Light Street called Sammy's, right near Burke's Tavern.
Right downtown Baltimore.
Yeah.
Right.
And then I would go in just to, you know, to schmy around. And we would talk politics, talk current events. He never said a thing. Years went by. He was managing another bookstore up on Calvert Street near the Mitchell Courthouse. I never knew any of this. And as you know, every year they have a kind of a service at the Holocaust Memorial downtown. And I was
right
there one year, and Leo was there in this big crowd, and he came over to me. And in the midst of this, he very quietly removed from his shirt pocket a yellow cloth Jewish star and very quietly said to me, "You know, I had to wear this during the war." I had no idea. Years had gone by. And so thereafter, anytime I would go into the bookstore, and he would tell me a story about this or that that happened during the war, and I would say, "Leo, you've got to write a book." And this went on for years. And finally, one night on the phone, I said to him, "Leo, you've got to write a book." And he said to me, "If you help me, I'll write it." And I really didn't want to.
Why not?
Because I was writing three columns a week for the Baltimore Sun at that point and five commentaries a week for WJZ-TV at the time. I was writing 400 pieces a year for 25 years. You know, I just felt like I didn't have the time. But how do you turn down something like that. So I knew that the centerpiece of the drama of those 7 years when he was on the run, when he was running from the Nazis, getting captured, escaping over and over, I knew that the dramatic centerpiece of it all was that night in 1942 when he and another young fellow, both of them in late teens, maybe 20, escaped from the freight train that held 1,000 prisoners on their way to Auschwitz.
One of the concentration and death camps.
Yes. And I said to him, I tell you what, put your thoughts on paper what it was like in that freight train. There were 50 people to a car, 20 cars, jammed in, no place to move, on your way to death. What was that like? And he sent me back 3 or 4 pages, and I sent him back about 150 questions. What were people saying? How were they dressed? What did they look like? Did they talk about God? What else were they talking about? What did it smell like? All of these questions to try to bring it texture and depth, and because he could tell a story that almost no one else could. He was in the freight train, and he would call me every few days, and he would say, Michael, I'm up to question 17. Michael, I'm up to question 40. Michael, wow. I'm up to question 65. And there was a piece of me who was saying, take your time, because I felt like I don't really have the time to take your time. Finally, I got the answers back, and I thought, oh, my God, I have to do this. And so we sat down, and the first time we sat down to really talk about the book, he brought with him a book that the French authorities had put together after the war. It was a book the size of a telephone directory with thousands and thousands and thousands of names in it of all those who had gone through a French holding camp at Drancy, which is a suburb of Paris, and where from there they were deported to one of the death camps. And it had a list of every name and date of birth, place of birth, and what happened to them when they got to the death camps. The book was published in 1978, and there the Germans were painstaking in their record keeping. 1,000 Jews, I'm reading from the book now, 1,000 Jews left Drancy on the raw morning of November 6, 1942. 773 were gassed on arrival at Auschwitz or died en route. Another 145 men and 82 women were selected for forced labor, of whom 4 men survived. Those are the Germans' own numbers. Leo is listed as one of the dead. He's listed as one of the dead.
Because that's the train he escaped from?
Because that's the train he escaped from. And in this mass confusion and chaos and all of these people being brought in at one time, he was simply listed in this assembly line as one of the dead. The book is his answer, is his way of saying,
I'm not dead.
I'm still here. And he had 70 years that he never imagined that he would get.
I remember when I interviewed the two of you the first time when the book first came out. Do you remember what year was that?
99, I believe. 99?
And I was just taken by the book and the writing of the book and the story. Before we talk a bit about Leo now and you're remembering him, let's talk a bit about what happened. I mean, I don't know if you want to read part of it or just say it all, but just to give this story about the escape and a bit about what happened to him during those years, because it's an amazing story. I think you said he must have been 17, 18. He was a kid. Maybe, yeah, whatever that age was.
19, yeah. He was a teenager.
Right.
He was living in Vienna. He actually saw Hitler when Hitler invaded Vienna. He was at his cousin's apartment, his uncle and aunt, and their daughter, Annie, is still alive, actually. She lives in Colombia. I saw her at the funeral. And it was the day that the Anschluss started. And he went downstairs.
You said a word.
The invasion of Vienna and the start of all of Europe coming under Hitler's thumb. And he went downstairs as this parade, this military parade, came in. And he saw Hitler and the welcome in Vienna, which later described themselves as Hitler's first victims, was warm and embracing and cheering and very fully orchestrated, of course. And over the coming months, it became clear that this was just the beginning of the annihilation of the Jews. Leo's father had died. his mother had Leo and two little sisters, and she said to him, "You're going to have to run. I can't. Your sisters are too young, but they're gonna take you and kill you. You have to run." And he's a teenage kid, and he begins to run. He swims the River Sauer in the middle of a cold, freezing night, fully clothed. He goes to Luxembourg. He crosses the Alps on feet that were so frozen and bloody that he literally could not pull his socks away from his feet. He is sent back at the Swiss border. He escapes from a holding camp at San Cyprian by crawling under barbed wire. It is one escape after another. He hides on floorboards in an attic, is captured over and over. He is at the holding camp at Drancy and
in France.
And they put him on this train in November morning in 1942. And he is standing there with another, with a cousin, with a friend. And the friend is singing old folk songs because he is a singer. And his cousin is there, and an old woman with holding a child who she's never even met before, and people are praying. And who are they praying to? I mean, where is God? He and this other kid, Manfred Silberwasser, look up in this, you know, they're jammed in there. There's no room to move. There's a pot in the middle of the train on the floor to if you have to urinate, which, of course, quickly overflows as the hours go by. They look up and there's a window with iron bars, horizontal iron bars. And Leo says, "What about that?" And he and this kid, Manfred Silberwasser, begin to try to pull apart the iron bars on the window. And people in the train are saying, "Don't do that. You'll hurt yourself." Can you imagine? You know,
right.
And others saying, "No, they'll hurt us. They'll kill us. They're going to kill us anyway." Other people respond. And an old woman sits and says, "You do it." And they start to try to pull these iron bars apart, and they can't. And somebody says, "How about sweaters? Wrap sweaters around them, and then we'll try to pull them apart with that." And that doesn't work. "How about traction? How about if we get some traction by wetting the sweater?" How do you wet the sweaters? Because there's urine sloshing about on the floor of this freight car with these doomed people, and they dip the sweaters into the urine, and that gives them traction. And the hours go by, and they're pulling desperately on these bars to try to get out. And they finally notice something that's coming out, and it's rust. And it makes them realize that they're beginning to pull them apart. And now in the middle of the night, in the middle of nowhere, they're waiting for the train to hit a curve so that it will slow down a little bit. And they're coming to a curve, and Leo climbs up, and they're boosting him up, some of the others. And, you know, some people are still saying, "Don't do it." And there's an old woman, and she has a crutch, and she points it at them and says, "You have to tell the story. Who else will tell the story?" And that's their final impetus in the face of their terror. Where are we going? There's no one out there to help us. What are we going to do? You go. Someone has to tell the story. And so Leo squeezes his way through these iron bars and clutches the top of the freight train, pulls himself out. Manfred comes out right behind him. And the two of them are clinging to the side of this freight train in the middle of the night. And as it hits the curve, they jump into the middle, into a swampy area, and the train stops. A light picked them up, and a guard saw shadows jumping. And they're lying there in this marshy area, hoping that, and suddenly they hear dogs barking, guard dogs, and the guards are yelling, "Look over here, look over here," and they're trying not to breathe. And then after a few minutes, in the silence, they hear the train pulling away again. They made it. And so, but now what? And they start walking. And they're walking through this rural area until they start to reach a few buildings. And it's the beginning of a village. And of course, it's the middle of the war, the middle of the night, and all the lights are out. And they see one light on, and it's a bakery. It's a guy who is baking bread for the next morning. And they knock on the door, and the guy says, we're not open till morning. And Leo says, we're not looking for bread. We need a priest. And he takes them to the village priest, who puts them up for the night. And he says, you have to leave here early because the German guards come here every day looking to see if we're hiding anyone. And from there, they make their way to another village and to another, and they finally make their way to Paris. And from there, they're there for a while, and then they, you know, they're constantly on the run. And they wind up, he winds up getting captured again. And but by the end of the war, he had joined the French resistance and survived. And it wasn't.
He fought with the underground, too, for a bit, right?
Yeah.
It was in the French, yes, the underground fighting
and
the Nazis.
It took him about a dozen years after the war before he finally learned that his mother and his two sisters, as well as countless uncles, aunts, cousins, had all been annihilated by the Nazis.
So he cut that Jewish star that he was wearing off of his clothes, but he kept it?
Yes.
That's also kind of...
He not only kept that star, he kept journals, he kept calendars, he kept photographs, he kept all kinds of records, which we used when we were putting the book together. He was arrested at one point and put in a jail, and he had he contacted the jail, and they had his jailed records. He had passed out in France toward the end of the war. The war is still going on, with a hernia, and a nurse saw him lying in the street and got him to a hospital, and he woke up with a nun standing over him saying, don't worry, as long as I'm here, you're all right. It was Sister Joan of Arc. And when we were putting the book together, he wrote a letter to the last known place where he knew that she was, to the hospital. And they said, she hasn't worked there for years. She's in an old age home. The last we knew, here's her address there. He wrote a letter to Sister Joan of Arc at this nursing home. I'm talking 50 years after the war. And he gets a letter back from her. I'm sitting there. I am literally writing the last pages of the book, and I get a call from Leo. Michael, I just got a letter back from Sister Joan of Arc talking about how she remembered him.
She remembered.
Yeah. And then he went back and saw her. And these became the last pages of the book. But if I could, I'd like to read the last page of the book.
Please do. Please.
All these years later, such secrets we uncover. In the summer of 1978, I found the French book Le Mémorial de Déportation des Juifs de France. The size of a telephone directory, the book contains lists and more lists of all of the convoys from France to the death camps. With trembling fingers, I found the convoy from November 6, 1942. It was number 42. When I found my name, a cold shiver ran through me. Those who had survived the camps were designated with an asterisk next to their names. When I found my name, I stared at my own death notice. There was no asterisk. I am listed as one of the ghosts of Auschwitz. I am listed with all those who stood in the final hours of their lives in convoy number 42, with their hunger and thirst and their fears and their bloodshot eyes and their babies crying and their simple desire to live out their natural lives, and were deprived of it by barbarians. I think of my fellow deportees still, the child separated from his parents on the loading platform, and the old man praying to an unseen God, my friend Tony and her husband Erich holding hands and consoling each other, the young fellow with the gangrenous leg kissing the tears from his girlfriend's face, my friend Albert singing one final bit of a sad folk tune, and the little boy sitting on the lap of the old woman who lifted her wooden crutch into the air and cried to Manfred Silberwasser and me, who else will tell the story? Now go, go ahead. And so we went. And after all these years, that is my final secret, which I now tell to all those who thought they had taken my life and thus mistakenly listed me among the dead. I am here, and this is the story of my arrival.
Hmm. I remember reading that book when you first wrote it. It's just such a powerful piece of work.
It's a powerful story.
It's a powerful story. The two of you together created a powerful his story.
Well,
but
well, I wrote it, but he lived it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But it takes two to make that happen, I think, in this
case.
Well,
he was he insisted that whole time, Michael, don't make me out to be a hero. Everything I did because I was scared to death.
You know, and I think it's important that Leo, just before he died, he never stopped being involved in life. He was lucid and active until the very moment he went to sleep and never woke up.
Yeah.
Right?
Went to sleep the night after his 93rd birthday and did not wake up. For me, one of the joys of this was after the book came out to go with him to different places where we would speak, to see him talking to young people and to watch their faces as he would talk. And look, you hear a number, 6 million, 6 million Jews killed by the Nazis for the crime of being Jewish. And what he was saying to them and is, here's a human face. I was your age. This is what happened to me when my mother, in order to save my life, had to send me away from her home. Imagine this could happen to you too, whatever your race or religion, it didn't matter. If we isolate people by any means, then that's wrong because we all share the same humanity. That was the message that he wanted to get out. And he did it right to the very end. There were kids there from John Carroll High School in Carroll County at the funeral because they had been so touched that they wanted to be there at the end for him.
Yeah, you saw people at his funeral. It was that mix of all ages, races, religions, cultures in Baltimore, Maryland, who came to sit and honor Leo and his passing.
Yeah, we used to talk about that this was, for both of us, kind of our legacy, that we got the story out.
Yeah.
And that the story was not just his. It was about the legacy that we have of our common humanity, that we can't let such a thing happen, that we can't divide ourselves by any kind of artificial means.
You know, and to the very end, he was testifying before the state legislature. He was supposed to do it the day he passed away.
Yeah.
And he was talking about the company that was building the Purple Line, the same company that made the cattle cars that and ran the cattle cars that killed 6 million Jews and 5 million others. 11 million people died in those concentration camps. Their cars, and he was saying, until they come up with reparations for all the people, Jews and everybody else who went through this, that you can't do business with this company. And that was what he was doing before he died.
Absolutely. He testified in Washington as well, before Congress. The message had to be made clear, not only that something unforgivable had happened, but that people had profited on the basis of this. People had profited and had driven the getaway car, as it were. And had profited by death, and he wanted that story to be out there too.
Leo Buchholz was an amazing human being. Our paths crossed because you let them cross when you wrote the book with him and introduced him to the world to him and to me. I was lucky enough to cross paths with him many times over the years on purpose and by accident. He was just an incredible human being.
Well, Mark, his message was your message. His message was my message. We've spent our lives, our careers, trying to say the same thing that he lived, that message that we're not different, that we share, that our differences are certainly nothing to demonize one another. Our differences should be embraced and should be celebrated, but not used as a way to harm each other. That was the message that Leo wanted to get out and that you want to get out every single day on the air.
Well, that's why I couldn't let the week go by without you come in and talk about Leo Buchholz. I wanted to make sure that this week did not go by without remembering him and talking about the book Leap Into Darkness and to say what did you say?
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Leo, for being on planet
Thank
with us.
Thank you, Leo, for a life well lived and 70 years of postscript that he never imagined and the Germans never imagined.
Leo Buchholz, rest in peace. On the way to break, you know what that is, Billie Jean by Michael Jackson. On this day in 1990, Michael Jackson was voted Artist of the Decade in the annual Soul Train Awards. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com.